We want to take a second to thank you for supporting Womance by listening to our podcast.
One great way that you can continue supporting us, including those listens, is hitting subscribe, telling a friend, leaving a review. That stuff all really matters.
Sharing it on your personal social media is another great way to spread the word about Womance. And another option for supporting us, if we may be so bold, is to recommend going to our Patreon, where you can donate as little as a dollar a month to help us spread the word of woe.
If you want to contribute more than a dollar a month, which obviously no pressure, whatever you've got, we are so appreciative to have, but we have awesome gifts for you. If you want a hand-addressed letter from Morgan and Isabeau, maybe with some special woe stickers, other merch.
Just visit our Patreon. We are Womance on Patreon, or is it patreon.com/womance? We would be very proud to call you one of our patrons.
All right, everyone. It's my great pleasure to officially welcome you to the Verdant Forks, Washington, by way of Otherworld Theater here in Chicago, Illinois, USA. My name's Morgan.
And I'm Isabeau.
And we co-host the weekly podcast Womance, a podcast about romance novels, our moment, our convoluted orgasm metaphors, and ourselves. And we are very excited to be hosting this panel for some really exciting romanticy authors. And entering the security code on our cell phone. All right. So we're going to go ahead and introduce our panel, and then we'll get started with some questions that we have prepared. And then if any audience members have questions, you will absolutely be more than welcome to pipe in.
So we're going to start with Samara, who writes books about women in improbable circumstances falling in love, such as A Walk Between Worlds and her most recent, A Long Time Dead, the story of two vampires, Roisin and Novice Poppy, falling in love somewhere foggy in 1837.
Megan Mackey is a Chicago-based writer. She started her writing career as an indie author and had such smashing success in her first year with her inaugural book, The Finder of the Lucky Devil, that she made the transition to traditional publishing, including Silver Blood Scion, a classic high priestess come human sacrifice meets revenge-seeking demon love story. She's also a contributing writer for RPG's Legend Lore and Legend Lore : Legacies by Onyx Path Publishing and Sirens : Battle of the Bards. Through Apotheosis Studios. Apotheosis. That's a good name.
It's a great name. Tamara, if you'd pronounce your last name for me, I'm 100%. I want to get it right.
Yeah, Jure.
Jure. Jure. Tamara Jure is an indie bookseller based in Chicago, a Twilight era reader with an academic background in writing. They love combining speculative and literary tropes within the paranormal romance genre. We'll get to that. Their short stories have appeared in the Shirley Jackson award-winning anthologies Unfettered Hexes, Queer Tales of Insatiable Darkness, and Professor Charlatan Bardo's travel anthology. The Fall That Saved Us is their debut novel, and a finalist for the Indie Ink Award has been described as fresh, sapphic, compulsively readable paranormal romance filled with yearning darkness and beautifully crafted characters.
And last but not least, we have Melanie Michella.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. An escapist reader and writer from the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Melanie's debut work, The Rake Writer Series, blends emotional introspection with dragon-loving adventure. Very cool. Well, thank you to all of our panelists and to all of you for joining us. And yeah, Isabeau, do you want to start off with the first question? Of your choosing?
Okay, this is actually something that we talk about on our podcast quite a bit. Both Morgan and I are longtime fan fiction readers. So one of the things that we wanted to ask each of you is when you're choosing to inhabit these worlds, is it, why do you, if you choose to build an entirely new world, why that choice? And if you choose to build like a sort of pocket world that has like some of the accoutrements, the recognizable pieces, the minivans of our own, and then you add something to it, like why that choice? Like what is the draw for both, for all of you in the sense of like building your whole new world or like sort of inserting the magical into the one we currently inhabit?
So I like to either build a whole new world or go into history a little bit okay. because I'm escapist reader and writer. Like I don't personally like to write about the modern times because I want to get away from my life, yeah. away from my toddler and my minivan and go somewhere a little more exciting. So that's my answer.
Makes a lot of sense. Interesting that you mentioned history. I wonder how much historicity actually informs the world that you build, or are you really just trying to generate it from other references or your own imagination or those white mountains of New Hampshire?
So the world that I built for the Rake Rider series, it's very familiar fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of world building because I don't want you to have to think that hard, you know?
Okay. So
it's like a little medieval, definitely, yeah. and also just feels like familiar fantasy. And then what I'm currently working on is set in 1900. So just going back far enough that it doesn't feel like modern times.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. That point of view about making it accessible for readers and so making it kind of a more familiar fantasy. Is anyone kind of trying to not do that, to discomfit readers when they enter the world?
Not exactly. But I am trying to. So when you mentioned, you know, these historical worlds, mine is set in the Victorian era. And the Victorian era had its first, you know, British queer scandals, Cleveland Street, Bolton Park, and Oscar Wilde. And my world that I create with these vampires is very much like a queer enclave. And I'm not trying to discomfort or unsettle anyone, but I am trying to shed light on the fact that our notions of this era are incomplete.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Samara.
Gentleman Jack. Well, that's a little, I think that might be Georgian, but it's close. Close.
You're right, it's Georgian. But it's like the Victorian came right after the Georgian period. Also, I learned that by reading romance novels. Like, I know so much, or like made up so much about British history and like the difference between a chaise and a barouche because I read a lot of historical novels.
Made up so much.
For me, that's a strange question to ask because I write the depth and breadth. I've written in modern times, I've written in the far, far past, I've written in the middle of the, you know. I have, like, my urban fantasy is very modern, and my focus there, because it was my first series, it was like, I don't need to reinvent the wheel mm-hmm. when I do that, and then I didn't need to make it as hard, like, I based it even in Chicago, I was like, let's not make this as hard, like, let's get the characters down, let's get the relationships mm-hmm. and stuff, not make it as hard on me as I can. Like, I created in Silverblood an entirely ancient world where gods still walk the earth and demons are existing, and I created my own pantheon of gods with their own rules. And that was me diving into watching like BBC history mm-hmm. and archaeological videos of that time period during the Copper Age and trying, again, not to need to reinvent the wheel unless I had to reinvent the wheel. So like, what do I need? When do I need it? Do these characters need that information? Mm-hmm. And that kind of dictates what exists in that world.
You anticipated my follow-up perfectly, which is like, how do you keep track? Mm-hmm. How do you manage that? Do you plan? Do you overplan? Are you, you sound like you kind of lean on the side of like, I want to have the same information my characters have, no more, no less.
Well, what you're getting into is I am known as a planter. So there's people who fight right, but they say they're pants.
Right.
There's planners who outline everything and have the notebooks.
Yeah.
I'm a planter. Because I'm a trained actor, so I'm not a failed actor because I just wanted a novel writing for a choice. But so what I'm doing is like I have everything bullet pointed out, like, you know, what I want the book to be for the most part, the chapters, maybe if I go a little deeper than that, and then I start acting and I start performing it and living it, and then I come up with the sexier choice. In my other series, I'm realizing I have what I call continuity drift, where you start to remember things differently and it drifts and you have to come back to the lines, or you have to retcon hard, which I had to do in my third book of my double series, because I had been calling them demons the whole time and I thought I was calling them devils, and we had to retcon why that was. So what a tool I need to be starting to use that a lot of really professional authors do, and a lot of editors who work with those professional authors, have something called the book Bible. Mm-hmm. They keep the facts straight. Now, like, Jim Butcher has a fucking Wikipedia that does that. I try to start a book bible, and then the editors and the quality control people add to it because they're going to catch things while my brain is present in the story. I don't see it until 6 months later when I go to reread it. I'm like, crap, that's wrong.
Yeah, I feel like that's such a particular challenge of writers in fantasy and science fiction, which is
you're making up your own world.
Exactly. Keeping track of those details because readers will absolutely keep track of those details. You never know what's gonna like resonate.
Lots of
details. yeah, exactly. Tamara, what about you?
Yeah, I feel like as far as the like fantasy world versus our world question, I feel like a lot of that is unconscious. Like the kind of, I usually start from character,
mm-hmm.
and then whatever themes I'm wanting to hit, like kind of dictate whether, you know, like, this is a whole world that I'm building. So I started with short story writing. I find it interesting that pretty much all of my short stories are, you know, like another world. Mm-hmm. And then when I got to novels and just longer stuff, then it was all this world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is. I feel like for a short story, there's less to maintain. There's less maintenance. Mm-hmm. There's no like I don't need a continuity bible for my 6,000 word short story. So maybe that's why is I feel like when I'm writing something shorter, I feel like there's just, you know, it sounds weird, but when the work is shorter, there's more room to explore, I feel, to just like get like really, really weird.
Zoom in, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I have a short story about like this world where looking at the moon makes people high, which I feel like is, I mean, maybe I could write a novel about that world, but it would feel very different in a short story. I just have to be like, you know, like this is the fact of this world, and then I'm moving on.
Yeah,
drop in detail and not justify it,
right? Because the driving force of it isn't like a propulsion of an entire narrative arc so much as like a anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This question, we've kind of pointed towards it, winked at it a little bit, but a lot of you consider your work or describe it somewhere on your website as paranormal romance.
Mm-hmm.
But we are at the Romanticy Fest, and I think that's the more popular hashtag right now. And I wonder if, as writers, do you think of these as like how discreet are these generic identities, or not discrete, as it might be?
Discrete.
Yeah, separate and individualistic.
Is this a Venn diagram? Are they separate circles? Like, how far out do these concentric circles live in your minds?
And perhaps as a more interesting follow-up, why is romanticy kind of grabbing people's imagination at this point? It's been baking.
No, I think they all overlap, to answer your first question. I mean, it's hard to, especially when you're writing a series, it's sometimes hard to pick a genre because the series can start in one place and then move to a different place as well. So I sometimes say, you know, fantasy romance. I sometimes say new adult fantasy. I mm-hmm. sometimes say high fantasy. It just depends because they're all true.
Mm-hmm.
And then what was your second question? I forget.
Is there, it seems like romanticy has kind of grabbed people's imagination most recently as like the term de art versus like
it's a flashy new thing right now.
Yeah.
For a little while, I think it has a lot to do with Sarah J. Maas, but it also has a lot to do with the comfort of some of these tropes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think Faded Mate has this really, you know, beautiful type of thing that I think is, you know, sometimes limiting, but also like I have the comfort of knowing that this is someone who will not leave me. This is a strong person who has this intrinsic draw towards me, and magically the laws of this world are that like this person is in my corner. And I think a lot of the things in those books, like there's a lot of self-sacrifice, there's mm-hmm. a lot of, you know, monster men in beautiful ways, and I think that
Beasties
takes a lot of like, pardon?
Beasties and Why We Love the Moment.
I think there's a lot of comfort and there's a lot of fodder for imagination. It kind of opens up a sandbox of playing around in there with I don't want to say self-insert, but like, you know, imagining yourself in that kind of space.
So many books, if you're doing them, you know, like a recipe or a bakery thing, you've got several ingredients that are comprising the whole narrative. And sometimes you want to highlight the blueberries in these muffins versus the poppy seeds, you know, but this guy is a poppy seed guy. So you're going to emphasize epic fantasy side of it. But there is a slow burn romance going on there, but he's more likely to accept that as part of the mix if I say it's this. And these things work. So I feel like romanticism is coming up. I feel, this is my opinion, I feel it's because everybody who grew up reading Harry Potter is now an adult, wants that joy and wonder of Harry Potter, but would like some like adult laying of parts and bodies and stuff. And then this is a conclusion I've come to just recently, because I write across a bazillion genres. And it is about explaining to people, which book are you going to gravitate more towards to get into my worlds? Mm-hmm. So I've gotten to play the genre shell game. And then sometimes too, it's like once you've tapped a market, so like I've tapped the paranormal romance market, and paranormal romance to me usually means werewolves, vampires, cryptids. Mothman is having a moment right now that is also romance structure, and romance is like a souffle. It has a romance has a very specific recipe you must follow to call it romance. Mm-hmm. If you can have all the deviations within that, but if you don't have these components, it's not a romance. Where you can have anything else genre, like, and it can have romantic elements, but that doesn't make it a romance. Mm-hmm. And romanticism hits a little harder on the it's a romance.
Yeah, I feel like I'm still figuring this out, because I stumbled into the romance genre as a writer, because for so long I was like, I'm a fantasy writer. And then at some point I was like, oh, all of my work pretty much has some, like all of my work has a romance in it. I'm just not hitting the like HEA at the end exactly as like a romance reader would want me to, with my short stories that I was writing. And so at least for me, since I feel like I'm still learning so much, romanticism is interesting in that like other people have called my work romanticism. I've been calling it paranormal romance, mostly just to like narrow in on, like you said, like it's mostly about, you know, werewolves, vampires, demons, I feel is how people, and the fact that it's set in like this world and not a secondary world. And so I feel like for me, romanticism is kind of acting as an umbrella. There's romanticism underneath that, you know, there's all of the genres that have some kind of fantastical element and some kind of, you know, central relationship plot. It's kind of how I've been imagining it so far.
It almost like unspools or uncomplicates the way we think about genre, which I think a lot of times working in a podcast that is a romance podcast, we spend a lot of time trying to like label things.
We do.
And make it easier to understand or like plug in or access. It never actually works that way though. So
yeah.
There's one thing that actually Tamara does very well. I think part of paranormal romance and romanticism is that there is a juxtaposition between fear and attraction. And there's a gothic romance writer whose name escapes me, but she referred to horror and romance as the wet genres.
Haley Piper.
Yes.
Sorry, I'll wait.
It's genres that you feel before you process intellectually, and things that get a bodily response, horror and romance. And I think that romanticism does that well. I think that, you know, people aren't really tapping into the right part of it as much, or like realizing that they're experiencing the fright part of it as much, but it's all sort of like agitating.
I think agitating is a gorgeous word for both romance and romanticism, and like these other sorts of feelings, because like in, let's say, a traditional like rom-com, right, the agitation is very much centered on the couple and like the obstacles that they might encounter versus like the obstacles the world begins to throw at the couple. And so if you guys could speak a little more about how you craft characters and have them encounter obstacles, and how you think about like that push-pull that's so delighting and delicious in romance, about like, we know these two people should be together, but like, what's gonna be thrown at them? Like, how do you guys approach that?
No, I'm kind of studying Korean drama, K-dramas right now, because they seem to have a slightly different formula from American-sized stories, where we have the meet, the conflict, they fall apart, they fall in love, happy ever after. And the Korean dramas that I've been watching have that too, but then the story keeps going, and then the world attacks the couple and tries to break it apart, and they have to transcend those things. So I've been really, like, breaking apart that story, where it's like, you know, that's a really interesting thing that we don't have as often, because usually you get to happy ever after, off to the sunset, everybody's great.
Right. They might have a cameo in a subsequent novel, but it's never about them again, or very rarely.
It's not about the world coming for you now. Now that we've worked this thing out personally, are you strong enough to stay together?
For me, it's like, you know, characters go on arcs. They go from point A to point B. And for me, it's always, how does this character get this one from A to B? And how does this character get this one from A to B? Yeah, how do they affect each other? How do they help each other grow? And how do they, you know, earn each other at the end? How does the work that they do act in service of their relationship?
So it sounds like you kind of rely more on a romance skeleton for your stories rather than something like an epic quest. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Is there any reason for that beyond that's what you like to do? Is there like practical?
I'm not great at plot, so that's number one.
It's fine, we're here for the characters anyway.
It's personal stuff, and the way people live for each other and act every day for each other and betray each other and move each other, that interests me far more than a world and its events forcing people to move. I mean, like, there has to be some of that. You can't just the first third of my book is two people stuck in a house. it's a good time for them. But eventually,
sounds like parts of my 2020.
COVID, learning how to not eat people. But you know, eventually the world does come calling, and I think that it's more rewarding when these people face the world after they have faced each other.
Interesting.
And the romance structure doesn't necessarily have to end in a romance. So, like, I've used that relationship building structure in my mid-grade science fiction about Pavlov's dog and Schrodinger's cat. So, like, the cat and dog characters are not going to have a romantic relationship. This is for 12-year-olds. But I still followed the similar souffle structure of they needing something from each other, breaking apart to come together to be friends in order to move forward with the story. So,
right? I never really think about structure, if I'm being honest, but I'm right there with Samara in that I find it much more compelling when, you know, the forces keeping the characters apart, internal conflicts, as opposed to just like literal distance or anything like that. And even, you know, even though my fantasy series is more of an epic fantasy and there's a war happening in their bed and like all this stuff, it's all about internal stuff. It really, like, because that's what I think is interesting. It's all about the characters and the emotions.
Yeah, I feel like thinking about just like which genre skeleton you're using is really interesting, because I feel like, especially when you're like pulling influences from a lot of different genres, so like romance and fantasy, yes, but like also like other people recently were like, oh, this is like a horror romance, and I was like, it's horror, and I had a whole epiphany the other day. But I feel similar in that the most interesting conflict to me right now with writing characters is, you know, like what is each has their own internal conflict. They're never well, and so they have to just like figure out, you know, how has my past kind of like impeded me from like being well enough to like embrace this other person the way that they need to be. And so that's kind of the thing that a lot of my work revolves around, is just like, how does this person need to heal in order to move forward?
I'm finding this really generative and inspiring, especially this kind of line. Everyone seems to be pulling into like horror in some way. Isabeau really does not enjoy straight horror. And really repels her.
Morgan loves it. So
I really enjoy it. And so we spend a lot of time trying to understand one another across this unbreachable gap. But it sounds like maybe it's breached.
Yeah. The bloodbath has been crossed.
There's a skeleton pathway. But I'm interested in what other kinds of influences really impact your work outside of just other romance novels or other fantasy works or other romantasy works. Outside of those, like, what do you bring the most to your work and influences your writing and character building, world building?
I mean, for me, it's emotion.
Yeah.
You know, I started writing my first series. I was really isolated at home as a stay-at-home mom in the pandemic. And, you know, guess what? My main character's motivation was isolation. I mean, I didn't really think about it at the time, but looking back, you know, it was like she's having these feelings of being isolated, of being trapped, and then she's making these almost desperate decisions to try to get herself out of that, which kind of propels the whole plot. But so, yeah, it's just, it starts with emotion, basically.
I have a feeling we all have a COVID book. That's your COVID book. What's your COVID book?
That was my first one.
That was your first one? My COVID book is my post zombie apocalypse, where the zombie apocalypse happens, and then after a certain amount of time, everybody just gets better, only for the outbreak to happen again and again and again, and we're trapped in this cycle of life, death, and rebirth. That's my COVID book. And what was your COVID book?
I guess it was my first book, which is just like a fantasy rom-com road trip.
We're trapped in the house, right?
No, that's my second book. I wrote that.
Oh, okay.
I do think COVID influenced
what COVID happened.
But no, I think during COVID, I was writing about people going somewhere.
Yeah, the escapist part of it, where it's like, I'm going to go to California. It's going to be warm and sunny, and there will be people there. Yeah.
I love your story about feeling isolated, especially as a mom, because I think Kathleen Woodiwiss, one of the kind of tentpole authors of the romance genre, was inspired similarly to write her first book. And you can tell because it's all about like going on a ship and going places. And she was not in a global pandemic. She was just by like nature of being a stay-at-home mother, really like longing.
It does something to your brain. I mean, I escaped into this daydream and that's what I did, you know, because your baby doesn't talk to you. Nobody talks to you. You know? So I'm just like, you know, nurturing her and like feeding this daydream in my head day after day. And it's like, maybe I should write it down.
Talking to other adults in your head.
Yep. Having a romance that was not happening.
Very interesting.
Yeah, actually a lot of romance writers have a very similar story.
They don't start writing until after procreating.
Yeah, they're Caroline Linden has a very similar story. Eloisa James.
Mm-hmm.
They all just...
Interesting.
It's good. Honestly, romance books are a great coping mechanism when you've been in a relationship a really long time and you want like a little extra excitement or something.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, you're escaping, but that's okay.
But you're bringing that energy back. We've talked about that because we're both in long-term committed relationships. And like, what is
it? Sorry.
Don't mean to break any hearts or dreams here. But one of the things we talk about is like, and you described it so beautifully, Samara, as like their wet books, in the sense that like you feel them. Right. And you had the name of the person who said that.
Oh, it was Haley Piper.
Haley Piper.
It was just like a tweet, but it was genius.
It is, so right? Because you feel it before you intellectualize it. And then this idea that like, as you're saying, Melanie, you bring that energy back out of your escape and into your life. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that you guys are putting into your books, right? Like the things that you're feeling and then other people are experiencing them via your books. And so like, can I ask you, as authors, like what has that been like? Writing is an incredibly vulnerable experience. You guys are putting yourselves out there. You're putting your COVID books out there. What has that been like for you?
So my book came out with a small indie press and then was listed as one of the New York Times best romances of 2023. And that brought people from outside of the self-selecting audience to the book. And I got a lot of interesting perspectives from readers, readers who came to it via horror, readers who came to it via just like turning the page and seeing it and thinking like, oh, might as well. But I also ran into people who just didn't get it. And that's been, you know, as a writer, reviews are not my business. That's none of my business. Go do your thing. That's not my business. But it's hard not to look at it, you know, from the corner of my eye and see like, my God, this is not, when you step outside of that audience, it's not as universal as you might hope it would be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sure, can you state the question again?
What has it been like for you to put your work out there?
Oh, right. So I always found it very extremely awkward, at least to start, how other people were talking and excited about things that were my sexual fantasies. And I was like, oh yeah, you now know something about me that I didn't
know. And now you want to talk to me about it.
Readers don't realize that, like, they get that you wrote it, but they don't realize that that's your personal thing.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Morgan and I try to separate authors from their sex scenes. We're like, we don't know that that's what they're into, but now that you've confirmed it for us.
Don't realize that that's, they think it's those characters. That's not the author's internal monologue.
And they should, Megan. That's fear.
It's me. Right? We feel awkward and they don't know we feel awkward. But it's more than that. It's like, you know, I know that I worked through my personal issues and philosophies and ideas and opinions, because if your work doesn't have an opinion in it, why are you writing it? You're just regurgitating tropes at that point. If you're not saying something with the work, and you can do that, and people make great careers off of that, and they make lots of money and stuff, but just don't expect me to want to eat it.
To answer your question, though, like, I mean, my books came out this past week, and it's such a vulnerable feeling. Like,
yeah, gosh.
In the world, all of my friends and family reading them and don't necessarily read romantasy, and I don't, it's like, I don't even want to know what they're thinking about. I don't know what anyone thinks about it.
Yeah.
It's scary. It's hard, you know. It's
especially different feeling when your grandmother reads your sexy book.
Just all of it, though, like reading my words. It's, mm-hmm. it's like,
it's yeah. tough.
But hopefully, I'll probably, you know, develop a thicker skin to it. But it's fresh.
Well, and like you were saying about reviews and stuff, authors never read the reviews, and we shouldn't read the reviews because that's not for us.
Yeah.
Never read my reviews.
I don't read them.
I don't read them when I'm mining for advertising. You know, like, here's what a positive thing somebody said about my video. You should try it too. That's the only time I read them, because so many people will put those reviews up and like, if I didn't put this review, how will the author know how to get better? And it's like, you're wrong if I'm actually reading it, because it's not for us, it's for the rest of you.
People have been extremely kind, and I feel like their reactions to my debut have been very touching,
mm-hmm.
because I have gotten several people who the book does not have religion in it, but it is a very strong, like, religious trauma metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people either just like comments on like Twitter or Instagram, or like a couple people have even emailed me, and, you know, just reaching out to be like, you know, like, this is so, like, this was very like moving for me, because I feel like I had like a similar experience, and it was like very cathartic to like see this character, mm-hmm. like having gone through like all of this stuff, and then like the hopeful ending, yeah, that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I feel like, as you know, like, obviously I wrote the book, so I have some very strong feelings about this as well, mm-hmm. so it's just I think that has been the coolest reaction to the book, is just people resonating with the themes, because I think that was the scariest thing about publishing this book, is I was like, I don't know what people are going to do with this. Like, I don't know what people's reactions are going to be to, like it is central to the book. It's not like a small thing. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I think it was a relief, and then just like I said, very touching to know that okay, like it's fine actually. Uh-huh. We're good.
And that's the thing, is not everyone's reaction mattered. Mm-hmm. Like matters, like, because if you even just touch a few people, mm-hmm. or like connect with a few people, I mean, I've gotten a couple emails, and that's the greatest feeling ever. They mm-hmm. felt so strongly about it that mm-hmm. they went and emailed me, you know. And mm-hmm. It helped me at least put down my reviews the other day. Like, I fell into that rabbit hole, and just knowing that a few people really loved it enough to reach out personally made all the difference and helped me kind of get past it.
Yeah.
It feels better than validation.
It's true. Yeah. I wonder, were you thinking about the religious trauma metaphor when you were writing, or did it just kind of unfurl?
It's one of those things where I started with like a very basic premise of like, what if Demon Hunter, who is retired because that was really dangerous and bad for her, mm-hmm. meets and falls in love with a demon? Wouldn't there be great tension there?
Yeah.
And so the first draft of that was actually a novella. And then when I started sending it out and getting revise and resubmit requests, and they were like, can you dig deeper into the characters? Can you like do all of this stuff? It was like in revision that it was much more conscious. And then that's when I was like, okay, so like, if this is a conscious thing I'm going to do, I want to do this like well, like this is not something I can just, I want to do it well. And so I think in revision, that was really when things solidified as far as character and theme.
Yeah. I think fantasy has this wonderful utility in that it kind of provides you a buffer. Whereas like romance is so incredibly vulnerable and squishy, and even writing it, you can't help but kind of divulge your deepest wants and needs. And that's such a vulnerable practice. And I wonder if in reception for your books, if you've been surprised by anything that has resonated with readers, or maybe the opposite, did not resonate, anything that's like surprised you along the way.
I guess it's kind of heavy, but my book deals with emotional abuse in a queer relationship,
mm-hmm.
Which Carmen Maria Machado writes about beautifully, and In the Dream House was a huge inspirational text for me as I was writing,
mm.
but it's still something we talk about, partner abuse, it is gendered.
Mm-hmm.
And it's often, you know, in a heterosexual relationship. And I've had people reach out to me saying that they felt themselves seen by this character who experienced this specific trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And that was gratifying and also hard. It's always hard to know that there are people out there having these horrible experiences, but it's also a connector.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest surprise when I started writing and stuff was discovering that I actually am funny,
mm-hmm.
because for a good portion of my life I was told that nothing I said was funny. I didn't have a good sense of humor. I wasn't very personable. I wasn't very charismatic. I would put these things that I kind of thought were funny, I thought it was jokes and broken expectations, and that would be the thing people come back to me about consistently, is like, this part was hilarious. And I'm like, really? You didn't see it coming?
I wonder, like, for everyone on the panel, how do you hope that spectacle works? Do you think about it as a tool?
I think in set pieces often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
we want to keep readers engaged, and a lot of the times when you are writing primarily about interpersonal conflict, you can get a little navel-gazy, you can get a little internal, you can get a little petty. And when people come to fantasy, romanticy, they want to be transported. And I think in terms of, you know, my God, the great sacrifice, the big fireworks, the, you know, just to give them what they came for, and also to be a culmination of all this internal work bursting out externally.
Mm-hmm. It's the what excites your attention. What excites our attention is writers will can excite the right attention in people as readers. And if you start to write stuff that doesn't excite your attention, it's going to fall flat no matter what you do.
I don't think that hard.
Yeah.
I don't think that hard. I daydream and then I write it down. And I guess, you know, my daydreams are enough to captivate me and I hope they're enough to captivate other people. I'm definitely not thinking too hard about whether it's like a spectacle or whether it's, you know, I guess I'm a pantser, Megan. I don't sit down and craft. I just experience and then I try to share the experience.
If you had to answer, why dragons?
Well, so I had just listened to the Aragon audiobooks. And this is a lot of my like internal daydreams start off of other books or movies. And that's kind of how it started. But, you know, if I'm being honest, Aragon was not really for me. It was lacking the romanticy. It was lacking the emotion and
more
the character
kissing.
Development.
Yeah.
Not just relationship, but just it was like for me. It was more world building.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I went into my own daydream that was kind of the opposite. It was like, okay, like dragons, riders, but all the character development and much less of the world building. There are no languages that anyone has to learn. I'm never going to write a language ever. So that was kind of why dragons.
Yeah.
But it could have been anything. Could have been badgers.
It could have been badgers if you just read Redwall.
Yeah. I can't wait for that Netflix series.
I feel like I'm very similar to Melanie. Usually I'm not thinking really hard about what would be flashy necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I do like sparkly magic. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I don't have a really firm plot, but I will have, you know, like the big turning point scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like those, like writing towards those, like that's where I'm like, there will be a cool sparkle here. But I feel like I usually am not thinking about it too, too hard.
Like an aesthetic almost that just resonates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it comes, and I feel like it, like whatever that big moment is like drawing from my character or theme. And so it feels like it's more of that rather than anything else.
What I like about your work, Tim, and I think this does have a bit of spectacle to it, is that you make really good use of ritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, you know, emotional made material in that way.
Nice little compliment for you there, here on the panel.
Now that you say that, I do love a good ritual. Yeah.
See, you're there even when you don't know you're there.
it's unconscious, I guess.
I'm also interested specifically in queer stories and how if fantasy feels like an especially rich soil for telling those kinds of stories, or if it, you know, is just an aesthetics that works for you and you want to tell queer stories.
Well, the great thing about fantasy is you can make up a world and then you can make up the rules for that world.
Uh-huh.
You know, and one of my books, they go to a land and everyone's non-binary and it's just how life is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the great thing about fantasy is you can make more accepting cultures than exist here and magic that helps people become their true selves and all of these things that don't necessarily exist in the real world.
Yeah.
I personally, you know, I liked when I was writing a long time dead to tap into the long history of queer-hooded vampires.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, as a Jewish person, it was interesting to work with vampires as they've long been a sort of derogatory metaphor about Jewish people. But there is something really fun about being a queer monster, being by necessity outside of society, being, you know, intrinsically a person who is not going to follow the path that is the standard path. And, you know, if you follow the vampire queer metaphor down its most literal hallway, you're going to end up somewhere problematic because queer people aren't predators, you know, queer people.
to.
Encoded as evil for too long, but also there's something delightful in that. Like I was talking to a friend about this, that as a queer person, a very common experience is being in a locker room and being so scared to accidentally look at somebody because suddenly you're the lesbian. Even if you're not trying to, but you know that there's something off about you. And there's something exceptionally freeing about saying, like, maybe I am a predator. Like, you have no idea. Maybe there is this predatory thing in me. And I think the queer monster really gives way to a lot of, you know, explosive, mosaic, queer metaphors.
I had the same experience where, like, I am straight, but it was a huge for a long time being a lesbian because, you know, we were in locker room and I was, like, curious and would look around and the accusation is, like, sort of, like, monsterizing somebody,
yeah,
and not being able to speak for yourself who you are,
for sure.
Yeah,
I think for me it's like I grew up reading a lot of paranormal fiction, and feeling like an outsider, you know, like, and so I think it's not even something I really think about when I'm writing. I'm just like, of course this is going to be another book about lesbians, why wouldn't it be, like, I still feel like there's so much room for us in these genres. And so I don't know, like, it's the queer monster, I love a monstrous lady, like, the love interest in my first book, I mean, she is, you know, like the trope of, like, the dangerous hot lady who just, like, kills bad men because it's funny to her. And it's just, I think it's just fun to, like, lean into that,
yeah,
character. That trope is really fun for me.
Fantasy has long had a closer relationship with queer stories than most other genres, and there has to be a reason for that. And I also think of the fact that during lockdown, during the pandemic, it seemed like monster romances really entered the general consensus.
Planet of Barbarians.
Yeah.
Yeah, they went from an internet to a phenomenon to a trade publishing paperback.
Yeah, and, you know, and there's something to be said for the clip of those specific books. And, you know, the consumability of them. But I think there were also, you know, more obscure texts that were resonating with people. And I think that kind of shared experience of feeling isolated and feeling dangerous, I think maybe compelled more people. And maybe that's one of the reasons romanticy now has this umbrella term now and is kind of more in the zeitgeist.
The interesting thing for me about, like, monster romance as separate from maybe just like paranormal romance, like just a vampire, there's always like the tension and like attraction between, like, I mean, I think, like, this is what happened for so many people when, like, we first read Twilight and it was really big. We were like, oh, like, isn't that, like, so interesting, like, maybe you're just like a normal, you're just an average person, and then this, like, hot monstrous person thinks you're interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it is just like, it's an interesting and enduring fantasy.
Yeah, it's the taming of the monster with love.
And there's, I feel like that's also related to the like enemies to lovers, where you have like everyone loves like a knife up the throat scene, but like, it could happen, but it's not. The danger is attractive. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a kind of, I think, probably myth that romance had to start with sexually explicit romance had to start with bodice rippers because we were, like, morally indignant about the idea of someone voluntarily losing their virginity. And that seems like a mythos. It seems like maybe we're more interested in, like, something dangerous happening. Like, love feels inherently dangerous, and being able to enact it feels much more reparative.
Or Olympus is pretty popular, and that's about a healthy relationship.
You know? Yeah, based on an extremely...
Consent is pretty sexy right now.
Yeah, but you know, it's interesting that Laura Olympus kind of hit, because the story, I'm kind of getting exhausted by people acting like Hades is a good guy in that story.
He's an abductor. Like the reclamation of Hades, I think, is really interesting. We've seen a lot.
Yeah, reclamation.
Was faithful to his wife too, so there's a lot of sides to that.
I mean,
what you can explore a lot of fodder
for sure, right? Yeah, like, it's like as you said earlier, Samara. There's like a sandbox aspect of it where it's like there are lots of corners, there are lots of toys to play with, and I think like what you're talking about here with like this. The aspect of danger itself is also sexy, but the very powerful and like in traditional romance, it might be a duke, but in monster romance or romantasy, yeah. It's somebody who has actual magical powers that could overpower you in really particular ways. And yeah. Like that proximity to danger and romance is inherently fun.
Or maybe you're the vampire, or maybe you're inherently monstrous in your beige maxi skirt. And you just need another monster to understand that that's in fact cool and hot.
What I really love is when they both have a power that is like dangerous or toxic yeah. to the other. I love when they're both weird and monstrous is my yeah. favorite pairing.
Yeah. Okay, see, and I'm leaning more towards right now into being interested in the monstrous female and the accepting male mm-hmm. versus what is more common, which is the monstrous male and the accepting female.
I think this is a good place to open it up for audience questions.
Yeah.
What is monstrous? Who are we?
You have to ask what is monstrous.
You don't. That's a test.
Do you want to feel like the romance genre is going to stay? You know, that Goodreads introduced it as its own genre like last year. And then the follow-up question. Do we see more combinations of genres coming up? Are we going to see a roarer? It's horror or something.
Roarer.
You should trademark that now.
Yeah.
I think romance sci-fi is coming because I'm starting to hear people talk about, like, there aren't really a whole lot of romances in science fiction, is there?
I'm seeing a rise in gothics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, Freddy's Moon and Arn Virtues. And, you know, there's some interesting, spookier and leading more traditional gothic, more like 18th century mm-hmm. is coming.
Well, and there's sometimes rebranding of old stuff, so like urban fantasy actually arises out of the noir tradition.
I think romantasy is here to stay. I think, you know, like Megan said earlier, we all grew up with like Twilight and Shadowhunters, and mm-hmm. we just wanted that but like a bit further, a bit more adult too. Yeah, and we're still alive and we still like these things. So yeah.
Richness, complexity.
Yeah.
Romanticism is staying. And then also it's interesting. I mean, so many authors are calling their work horror romance now.
Yeah.
Because I mean, Frady's calls their work horror romance. And I think I've noticed a lot more, especially indie authors yeah. are. Mm-hmm. I know that Hayley Piper also like calls her work horror romance. Some the ones that are romance. And I feel like in general, really rigid genre feels like it's like breaking down. Like I feel like so many people are combining aspects of different things.
The next audience question was, which tropes do you want to see leave and which tropes do you want to see more of?
Woman in the refrigerator, that trope can die and be buried and be lost in the Black Sea. Do you guys know what that trope is?
No.
Woman dies to further man's storyline and he goes on a path of revenge. That trope can just up off. I am sick of that trope being the answer to most things.
Mm.
It's like, because this female character who's probably also just a self-embodied needs to die so he can have an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sick of magic schools. Personally,
magic schools.
I'm kind of over like the we get separated into what, you know, magic we have or what creature we are or whatever. I'm pretty
yeah.
into that.
Yeah, school segregation isn't really that great.
This might be a little controversial, but I'm a little over who hurt you. I know a lot of people really like it, and I know it like pulls out that protective thing. That's great, but it's just like, oh, who did this?
society. Just like how long you got.
Good question.
Like toxic masculinity too that I'm not really into.
Yeah, toxic relationships being sexy are kind of done.
See, I say that and then I read it.
Romance is the thing that gets read most. It's just like,
my favorites always are going to be Fated Mates and Forbidden Love.
What pro or con?
Oh no, those are my favorites. Those,
like, yeah, pros.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what you love. Mm-hmm.
Is there a trope anyone else loves?
Beauty and the Beast. It's my jam. Beauty and the Beast. I love the forgiveness aspects, the monster. I love the self-realization and the growth that comes with it. I love all its variations, retellings, from like Scraggle Tag to the Hedgehog Knight, to every version of that. It's just, that is my meat and potatoes.
I love found families. Mm-hmm. It's like my dream. It's my life dream, you know?
You'd like to find a family. Yes.
Creating one, it's like, it's fine.
Just creating one, I had to grow its bone.
My like ragtag group of, you know,
families. Yeah.
It just feels good when you're reading.
Yeah.
A smaller trope that I discovered recently that I'm in love with, that I need to explore maybe a little more with my therapist, is dads that show up.
Mm-hmm.
Dads that show up and like Hazbin Hotel, and got me like that song, you know, more than anything right now, where she's talking to her dad and he shows up for her and it's just like, oh, that is yummy.
It's like, there are a lot of bad dads in this genre.
Here's what I love.
There we go.
A feral state.
Oh, yeah.
When there's something that you have to fight back, or it just comes at you, and finally you get to use it.
You have to make a choice.
You have to make a choice, but like, you know, you've been pushing it down. Suddenly it's like, go loose.
Nalali Singh has a wonderful one because she does a lot of shifters, and one my favorite of her shifter romances is where he's like of the Jaguar clan or whatever, but he can't shift into it. And when he finally shifts in at like the climax of the story, it is so good. I'm like, I don't even care about the romance anymore. You did the thing like that you hit. Yes, absolutely. I would love to see more of that.
Because it works.
Feral State was really good.
See, I would say, yeah, I mean, I don't like toxic masculinity in real life, but Beauty and the Beast being a beloved trope of mine as well. I mean, that kind of begs for it. Any other audience questions? Yes, favorite thing you've read lately?
My own books. I hate to admit it, but right now, part of the reason I write the books I write is because I really want to read that specific thing and I can't find it, so I went and wrote it.
I'm reading a Beverly Jenkins called Wild Sweetheart.
Nice.
and I think that's what it's called, Wild Sweetheart. And she's this bank robber from the South, and she's in jail for a couple of years, and then she's on parole, and she goes to live with this older woman, and the older woman's son is like real buttoned up, and he's this longtime bachelor, and he's a gambler, and she's like, oh, you tin horn, and he's like, you shush. And she, like, they ride horses, and she's like wild, and he never tells her to lose what makes her so wild and free. And I love Beverly Jenkins.
Mm.
So this is it's a really fun one.
Shoot, I think you might have sold me one.
Yeah.
Her books make me homesick for Western Kansas, which is no small feat.
I think my favorite things, I keep reading books about unwell artists. And so the one that I finished recently is Martyred by Kaveh Akbar. And it's about this poet who's like essentially going on this quest.
Mm-hmm.
To just like try and understand like his historic martyrs, also contemporary martyrs, and also unravel this whole like this family like tragedy, and him like dealing with like sobriety. And it's just like, it's all of these really, it's, I love the structure of it too, because there's poetry, because the author's a poet first. Mm-hmm. So we get like the poetry excerpts of the manuscript that the main characters writing. And then the other book that I'm currently reading that I'm really excited about is Your Love Is Not Good, by Joanna Hedva. And it is about a biracial woman in an art program, and then just like navigating the art world and how race affects how you present your work to the world and how you like navigate mm-hmm. in these spaces. Yeah. So mm-hmm. both of those have been really, really fun.
A confession, since I started writing, I've been having a hard time enjoying reading. It's tough not to compare, or I read the words and then the words in my head start to flow mm-hmm. and I want to do that instead. And I've only been writing a couple of years. I'm still kind of trying to find my way back to reading and mm-hmm. consuming and not just creating all the time.
Interesting.
It's a different headspace for me.
You know how the sausage is made. It can be harder to eat the sausage.
Maybe that's part of it.
But that's
I think you're still hungry, by the way.
Yeah, yet another food metaphor. I think we had a question here.
Yeah, I'm a book coach, and so I'm always really curious about how people show up for the reading process. What is a day in your life like a day when you're writing your manuscript? You mean every day? Yeah, I mean, if that's it, if it is every day, you know, especially like when you're trying to balance like work, kids, you've got animals to take care of. How do you tap into like how you turn off the everyday mind and like tap into that creative space, so that way
the flow. For me, it's music. I like to listen to a certain playlist, and that helps because I do have a kid and I have like three pets and I have all this going on. I don't always know when I'm going to get to write. I don't have a set schedule because it's kind of like, well, my husband has a meeting, I have to take our daughter, and if he doesn't, maybe I can write. And so I always put in my AirPods and, you know, tune everything else out, listen to a certain playlist that has music that's kind of matches the tone of what I'm writing. And that helps. But for me, honestly, it's hard because I'm very much when I'm writing, I'm writing. And that's tough because my toddler is like exists all the time, believe it or not. Like every single day, she's still there. And so it can be really hard for me because when I'm in the groove, like sometimes I'll even go and like stay in a hotel for 3 days. I'll say to my husband, like, can I go on a little mini writer's retreat? Because I need to just write. Like I need to do this right now. And then I'm kind of in an off time at the moment where I'm not writing. And so kind of waves, but.
I lit a candle. I'm very like into smell. I've been lighting Cameo by Voicemails. And it has a double purpose because when my wife smells it, she's like, oh, I'm busy.
Or she wasn't, excuse me.
Yeah, it's and and I also do Pomodoros. I love my Pomodoro method. It's like it's either 20 or 25 minutes that you're on and then 5 minutes off and then on and then off and then on and then off. And then you take a 20-minute break.
That has a time.
Yeah, there's a timer. I have a silent timer for children. And it works really well because, you know, it's not too long of a period where you're like, I'm in this for an hour and I can't move. But, you know, you get these little breaks in between where you can, like, stand up or stretch or, like, you smell your can.
It's like couch to 5K for writing.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It works.
I've done a lot of different methods. Oh, I'm sorry, you go first because I'm gonna take a while.
Oh no, you're okay. I've also done the Pomodoro method. Sometimes I have to just like trick myself, like I have, you know, I'm like, I just have to write 5 words. That's it. Write 5 words. And like I never just write, like it's just a trick of like getting over the, oh no, what if there are no words today? Oh no, what if they're the wrong ones? Oh no, and like the what ifs will just keep piling up. So I'm like, if I just write 5, then, you know, that is more than I had before. And usually I'm going to write more than that because it just like simply typing something will spark, you know,
The paranoia is real. Like, yeah. If it's been a few weeks, I can convince myself that I will never be, like, I'll sit down and there will be nothing in my brain.
I'm curious, kind of along the same lines of that traditionally published question, are any of you, like, or how many of you are formally trained writers?
I'm an actor.
That's a trained right here.
I went to school for it.
I technically have a degree.
Yeah, admitted or anything.
Yeah. All right.
For an acting degree and stuff, it's like it doesn't necessarily guarantee success, but it gives you a structure to work from. And there's nothing wrong with that.
You
know?
Yeah.
What is it? Hugh Jackman has a master's in theater. It's like, you know what? He did just fine.
And before he became famous, he was a gym teacher.
Yeah.
He looks like a gym teacher.
Okay, so the rest of you write of your kind of figuring it out yourselves, and perhaps you got more of a structure in your academic background.
I feel like so I took a lot of things away from my program.
Uh-huh.
I did my MFA, and during the summer between my second and final year, I did the Odyssey Writing Workshop, which is okay. One of those like intensive 6-week workshops for speculative fiction writers. Mm-hmm. And I did that because I wasn't quite getting like the support for like that, like my interests as a fantasy writer, like in the MFA, because they tend to be much more focused on literary fiction.
Yeah. Interesting.
So I feel like I've pulled like the things from that have like worked for me. And then also just, of course, like learning so much on my own always.
All right, any other audience questions? All right, well, I think we can wrap up. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to the Otherworld Theater and to the Romanticy Fest for having us. And thank you to all of our authors for your wonderful insights and time and responses. It's been such a pleasure talking with all of you.
Thank you.
Woly guacamole, everyone! Thanks for listening to another episode of Womance.
Womance is hosted and produced by my friend Morgan.
And by my friend Isabel. Our logo artwork is by another friend, Mary Reichman. You can find her on Instagram at m.reichman, spelled R-E-I-S-C-H-M-A-N-N.
Original music by Nick Gravlin.
Editing and mixing for this episode was done by Steve Keel.
And our web mistress is Jane Bonzak. They're the best.
You're also the best. We so appreciate your support by listening. Please consider taking this to the next level by following, rating, and reviewing. We read every single review. Or even check us out on Patreon.
If you'd like more woe in your life, you can connect with us on Instagram at womance and on Twitter where we are @mance_woe. Or you can find more episodes and content at womancepodcast.com.
If you have an idea or just want to reach out, please email womancemail@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Womance is a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to add to your romance collection at frolic.media/podcasts. Until next time.